This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, frills and flirtations. What clothes bring to speculative fiction?
So this week, and I think this will probably come as a surprise to everybody, we're actually looking at fashion.
Yes, I'd like to point out how woefully unqualified I am to address this topic in any meaningful way, other than historical. Historical, I might be okay.
Yes, certainly I think in terms of the modern day, I have very little to contribute when it comes to sort of fashion movements and things like that. I know very little about it. But in a historical context, I know a little bit more. And, I guess we should probably explain why we're doing this episode to begin with.
Yeah, well, how about you field that one? Because this one was your idea, so explain where this came from.
It was my idea. Okay, so basically, Jules and I have been watching Bridgerton.
Yeah.
Which has come under fire for a lot of reasons. I mean, a lot of people have enjoyed it, but it's come under fire for a lot of reasons. And one of the most prominent reasons is a lot of people have been objecting to the historical inaccuracies of the clothing.
Yeah.
And it is. It is. The clothes are very historically inaccurate. The fabrics used, the styles, all of these things. It's incredibly fanciful. And I went into the series watching this knowing that, having already heard some of the complaints, that this was going to be very inaccurate, and looking at the clothes and going, oh, wow, really? And I came to the conclusion that I just didn't care.
Yeah, I kind of, certainly in a visual way, I found it quite engaging. What jerked me out of the story was not the fact that they were wearing the wrong sort of dresses, but was the sort of some of the attitudes and things where I was kind of like, yeah, that's not what happened. So without going down a rabbit hole in that direction, because it's supposed to be froth, it's supposed to be fantasy that's very, very light.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right. The clothes and the costumes were fantastic, but again, did not reflect the Regency era at all.
No, they really didn't. I mean, and kudos to the clothing department. They did put on a sort of a visually spectacular, you know, display. But it definitely wasn't of the era. There are a lot of modern styles, ideas, fabrics, etc., which were sort of mixed in there. And I think that would have been a problem if it was advertising itself as being historically accurate. But it wasn't. I mean, even the music, the whole point of the music was that the music was not of the era either.
Yeah.
It was modern music, but, you know.
Played classically.
Played classically.
Which I'm actually a big fan of. I've never heard Billie Eilish played like that. And I'm like, this is really good. I like this. I almost like it more than the original.
So, you know, the whole point was that they were recognizing the fact that this was not really a thing that they were doing, that it was meant to be chick flit. I was trying to say chick flit and a chick flick at the same time. So,
oh no, I think chick flit is good. Chick flit is good for this particular type of fantastical reimagining of the Regency era.
Yeah, it is, and it is. It's sort of magic realism, as it were. I saw it more as a fantasy than it was meant to be historical. The historical setting was just kind of to make certain parts of the story function, but really it wasn't entirely credible, and it wasn't supposed to be. And you knew it wasn't supposed to be historical anyway, because they made all sorts of other changes as well, starting with the fact that they had a very diverse cast, which was great fun actually.
Yeah, it was, and they even wove in a, you know, sort of like three lines of dialogue to explain why it was diverse and why history had taken this kind of alternate route.
Exactly. So, you know, it was magic realism. It was not supposed to be accurate, which is probably why I didn't really mind the costumes. But it did get me thinking about the way the costumes and the way that fashion has worked historically and is therefore reflected in fiction. And it is a big topic, and it's one that I am quite interested in. And I realised that we hadn't actually addressed it in Dissecting Dragons. So I messaged Jules like, hey, Jules, let's talk about fashion. And Jules was like,
Yeah, I expect Madeline could probably hear the crickets chirping from her end. But it's like, I am actually interested in it from a historical perspective, but in terms of being an absolute clothes horse, it's not me. It's functional. Yeah. It just sort of covers you and it's suitable to an occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, let's start by doing a very brief, very, very brief, very incredibly brief history of sort of fashion. Now, we've had notions of fashion for centuries across the world. In Europe, before the Renaissance period and the emergence of what would, you know, we'd consider to be the middle class, fashion was almost exclusively a thing of the noble and upper classes who could afford to have their clothes made for them. Up until that point, clothes were very much a functional sort of thing for the average person. It was just, I need to stay warm. And perhaps I will wear something, you know, which is particularly neat or something which is a nice colour or etc. for special occasions. But for the most part, I just kind of need to be dressed.
Yeah. In fact, you can drill it down even further from there. So this is kind of like a tiny, teeny little bit of social economics, if you like. Mm-hmm. What possible use does, I don't know, let's say a silver bead serve? Because you can't eat it. And it doesn't provide warmth. It doesn't put a roof over your head. So what good is it? If you think, let's say a silver bead takes 6 hours to make. Mm-hmm. That's 6 hours where you're not feeding yourself. You're not putting a roof over your head. You're not making yourself warm or, you know, looking after your family.
Yeah.
What it basically means is those 6 hours are leisure time. Leisure time creating something that is essentially useless. Yeah. But it's pretty. So this is something that we've actually been doing since we lived in caves. I mean, they used to decorate skins and things. They used to have you'd say fashion is a recent thing. You're right. The idea of fashion is definitely comparatively recent in human terms. But the idea of outdoing each other and having slightly more fabulous clothing or strange or something that made you stand out and look different has definitely been with us since sort of the Cro-Magnon times.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the idea of creating something is to say, it's a way of saying, I have leisure time, therefore I have wealth, in its most basic terms. And if you look at sort of tribal societies now, the ones that are really prosperous have leisure time to make things that are essentially useless.
Yeah.
And all fashion and everything like that, which, as you say, it was really done by sort of the gentry upwards, or the merchant class upwards, depending on where you are in history.
Yeah.
So having the leisure time to, you know, first of all, it's kind of like, do you have the leisure time to adorn yourself like this? These not practical clothes for working in. Therefore, you must spend a lot of time not working. And then it's a case of, you have lots of money, therefore you don't work in the same way someone would work in the fields. You're literally wearing hours of somebody else's life.
Yeah.
If you think about it. So it is a way of proclaiming wealth. Yeah. And yeah, we've been doing that for around sort of 15,000, 20,000 years, which is sort of disturbing, but then it became very sort of class-based as well. We've really refined that part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly when it comes to the idea of kind of fashion styles and things like that, that's incredibly modern, because then we're sort of entering the era where clothes are sort of made on a more industrial level. But before that, it was very much that there would be certain styles and things which would be in fashion. And yeah, it was about sort of showing wealth, you know, and comfort and things like that. Obviously, as time has gone on, styles and fashion became more and more available and more desirable up until, you know, the current day. So let's look at a few things that fashion has been used for and used to do over the years, because it's not just about looking pretty.
No, definitely not.
No. So one of the first things that fashion has done, or fashion styles have done over the years, is to enhance certain features or favoured features in different eras, you know, different standards of beauty, different ideals of beauty. You know, our ideal of what beautiful is has changed over the years. And as it did, we would have fashions which would enhance those different ideals and create, usually it was about the silhouette, it was creating a desirable silhouette. So a really good example of this is the hourglass shape, which continues to be popular in certain circles today. And it was created by emphasizing the width of the hips by having these huge skirts, or these huge sort of whalebone, you know, hip bits, and then the skirt would go out, and also enhancing the bust by having these large collars, so also the wide collar or the frills or things like that, which make that area appear bigger. And then between these two big areas, you would squeeze the waist in using a corset or something along those lines, or also using certain shapes in order to make it appear thinner. You just look at sort of Tudor clothing, for instance. They kind of did this in a different way, where they would have these clothes, the bodice, it would be like an arrow, sort of, it would sort of shape in, and that would create the illusion of something becoming thinner. That wasn't quite an hourglass, that was something different, but the hourglass in particular was very popular in the Victorian era.
Yeah, it was. Although we have to be a bit careful as well, because there was a fashion for, you know, a woman's waist being the size that a man could get his hands literally around it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that happened for about a hot 5 minutes in France. It's not actually that common, but yeah. Certainly, yeah, the whalebone corsets and things that actually distorted the ribs. There's another element to this sort of side of fashion here, which I think is worth addressing, because obviously you talked about the Tudor era, and you look at the medieval era before that as well, all of the medieval era, in fact, and again, sort of into the early part of the Edwardian era, the whole idea of women having very different clothing to men. Women don't actually need different clothing to men. I'm sure people must be aware of this, but everybody should be aware that women actually have a pair of legs. You know, even if they're wearing skirts, we're not just floating along. No, there are definitely legs there.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have legs. I have multiple, I don't know.
Tentacles. You know, if you do have tentacles, then we're going to have to keep our friendship at a distance, because I'm not good with squishy. I'm really sorry about that. Getting back to my point. So the idea was also to put people, with all fashion, in fact, was to put people where they belonged, their position in society. Women were considered weaker and subservient to men, so they were given clothing that made it harder for them to get around. That is a gross oversimplification, but that is partly what happened. Women were supposed to be the attractive, weaker sex, therefore they were given clothing that displayed them, but also made it more difficult for them to move around freely.
Yeah.
So you're looking at your corsets, your stomachers. Tudor era, by the way, small breasts were actually quite preferred. Large breasts were very out of fashion during that time, hence the stomachers. And, you know, loads of petticoats, the panniers that you mentioned with the wide skirts. Again, they got so ridiculous at one point that women could only get through doorways by moving sideways. They just sidle into rooms.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, a lot of that is basically like a peacock's tail. So some of it is kind of like, I'm displaying my wealth and privilege and power, etc., and I don't have to work for a living, and I'm just a dainty thing that really is only suitable for display, etc., amongst the upper classes.
Yeah. This is the thing that always got me, though, because it's always this idea that trousers are inherently for men and skirts are inherently for women, which actually doesn't really make a lot of sense, because actually it makes a lot more sense for men to wear skirts rather than restrictive clothing around that area of the body.
Yeah, I mean, the Scots have had it right for centuries now.
They have had it right. And also, to be honest, like, historically as well, trousers were invented for people who were horse riding, for people who were on horseback, because it was just more practical if you're on a horse to have some, you know, just something a little bit more comfortable there.
Well, they were also against the cold, because we have had some form of trousers again since the Stone Age.
Yeah, this is true, yeah, against the cold. But I mean, like, in the Roman era and stuff like that, they weren't wearing trousers.
No, but they were in a very hot country, most of them.
They were in a very hot country. And this is the other thing, is that actually it just makes a lot more sense in hot countries for you not to be wearing trousers. And in lots of cultures, people don't. I mean, you look in the UAE, you look at the sort of the traditional dress, that the dishdash, very elegant, long, like that. It just makes sense, to be honest. It just makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's different silhouettes enhancing different things. The next one, obviously we have already touched on this, but it was the idea to boast about wealth, and that was with the use of, you know, various fabrics as well, dyes, threading, patterns, ornamentation, anything along those lines. So to give you an example, pre-revolutionary France, anyone who's ever been to Versailles or things like that has an idea of the decadence of pre-revolutionary France amongst the aristos. They were so utterly separated from the reality of the world. Decadence was everywhere. It was all about, you know, just everything being alarmingly beautiful, if that makes sense, and obscenely decadent. And that was obviously also meant to be portrayed in the clothing that they wore, where they would have these skirts and these dresses which had so many layers upon layers of heavy silks and fabrics, to just say, I can afford these heavy silks and fabrics. And they'd have these huge wigs as well. And it's just this style which basically says, I cannot do anything practical, but I don't need to do anything practical. I just need to sit here and look pretty because I'm so wealthy.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing with having so many skirts and things, you only need a certain amount of material to cover you. So you're also saying, well, I've got all this. It's literally saying, I've got this excess.
Yeah.
I've got all this excess material that I don't actually need. There's a practical component to that style as well. Obviously, syphilis was rife at that particular time and in that particular area, not just in France, but across Europe, because people were getting into marriages that weren't necessarily making them happy, and then they were engaging in sexual activities in brothels and things, and then going off with mistresses and basically spreading a lot of venereal disease around.
Yes.
And I think it was Louis the 14th who made it fashionable to wear wigs in the first place, because he had syphilis and he lost all his hair. He also had facial lesions and things, which is where maquillage came in, which is the painting of the face white. And, you know, then you'd rouge the lips and cheeks and things, and you'd use the mucks, which were the little black patches.
Mm-hmm.
So, it got to the point, to cover up deficiencies, and you know, there was padding for the cheeks because they'd had a lot of sugar and they'd lost a lot of their teeth. So this was all very, very attractive. The smell must have been God almighty.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically, yeah, there was a practical side to it. But because everybody was doing it and kind of doing it boldly, it became the thing whereby you were actually declaring that you were part of the underclass by not wearing maquillage. So you were expected to wear it, even if you weren't pockmarked and toothless.
Yeah, exactly. And this, you see reimaginings of it today, and it is it does look rather grotesque, to be fair. But again, it was about the circumstance of the time. But which just meant that I can completely understand people saying, right, we're going to do this so that we hide the fact that we very clearly have syphilis. And, you know, it's the same with Elizabeth the First, who did wear quite heavy makeup and stuff like that, because it was scarlet fever. It was scarlet fever she had?
No, it was smallpox.
Smallpox, that was it, sorry. Smallpox, which marked her quite, you know, heavily. And so she would wear this big red wig, and she would wear a lot of white makeup, because also this the other time, another thing of the fashion was having very, very pale skin, because once again it was meant to denote wealth, because you didn't have to go out and toil under the sun. You could sit indoors, and therefore you had very, very pale skin. To the point where you see these portraits, particularly of Elizabethan England, where they're so pale that they've marked out the blue veins and stuff like that around their sort of their heads and things like that, because the idea was you're so pale you're almost see-through.
Yes. They must have had serious vitamin D deficiencies.
Incredible vitamin D deficiency. Okay, so, all right, so as well as that, there was also the fact that clothing was sometimes used politically as well. It was used to quietly signal affiliations, or was even used as acts of rebellion. So another example of this is, having talked about the decadence of pre-revolutionary France, post-revolutionary France really changed their style, and there's lots of things that have actually been heavily influenced, not just in France, but across Europe, based on the revolution and kind of the attitude toward the aristos, including the way that the direction we drive on roads. It was because of this. And the other thing is the style, the art style has moved from something which was quite gothic and sort of very decadent and things like that into the Greek inspired fashion as well. So the empire style, which is the one that you commonly see in period dramas, came into fashion because it was meant to be a direct attempt to move away from the previous decadence of the aristos style, where, you know, you had lots of fluff and bits and bobs, and then instead they wanted to move away from having these, you know, the busts and the waist, the small waist and the big hips and etc., into this very Greek, almost quite square style, which is the very high waist instead, and the very slim silhouette. You also see it in buildings, not a, you know, high waist and slim silhouette, but the switch to kind of the Greek versions. I mean, a good example is to see, in France, if you're in Paris, is to look at La Madeleine, which is this big Greek-style church. And, you know, you get all these, the sudden return of columns, just this idea of long and straight rather than curvaceous, essentially.
Yeah, a number of museums in London have this Greek Revival style as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting. With the Regency period dramas, particularly with a Jane Austen adaptation, the costumes are generally not accurate.
No.
As in, the book, the stories are being set probably about 20 to 30 years after they would have actually been set. So it still works. And we sort of assume that that is what things would have looked like. And we forget the fact that actually probably Darcy would have been wearing white powder and rouge. And
yeah, that's the thing.
And it would have been quite delicate. And it's kind of like, that does not fit our modern concepts of an attractive romantic hero.
No, you know, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, yeah.
But yeah, the sort of slim girlish silhouette. I mean, partly I think that's why they decided to go sod it, and with Bridgerton they just went, we're going to sort of keep that as a central style but branch around it. Because if you look, there were lots of different body types in Bridgerton, and yes, they tried to match that only to the people who genuinely had slim girlish silhouettes anyway. Right, because it's not a flattering style if you've actually got breasts and hips.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, it just looks kind of a bit ridiculous. Which is, yeah, and we'll actually talk a little bit about that and period dramas in a minute. But yes, I think this is also one of those big kind of misconceptions, is the idea that at any one period there was only one particular style of dress, and that everybody therefore had the same body type. They didn't. There wasn't. There was all sorts of things, and people did dress to what would suit them, but there were certainly fashions which people would kind of gear towards. And the idea of, you know, the empire style was also just the idea of not having quite, just having something a little bit more simple, the gathering up higher rather than lower so that you aren't emphasizing the waist so much, and having more sort of flowing skirts rather than a very heavy, you know, like layers and things like that. So yeah, that's what it was all about. It was political. And there have been other examples of people who've worn certain colours or certain styles in order to show affiliation with certain things. I mean, now I don't know how much credence I put into this, but, you know, following the Brexit vote, for instance, there are a lot of people who pointed out that the Queen came out wearing blue with little yellow flowers on her hat or something like that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said, well, this seems to, you know, she seems to be, that seems to be her very personally doing a small kind of nod towards the EU, in when she politically, you know, she cannot do that, but she can show personally what she feels by her clothing. Some people have said it was ridiculous and it was just a coincidence, whilst others have said the amount of organisation that goes into deciding what she wears, it can't have just been a coincidence. And if it was, it had to have been the dumbest, the dumbest coincidence ever.
Yeah, I see. I think that there might be some mileage on that, simply because obviously she's not allowed to show favouritism.
No.
But the fact that over the years, when something has struck her as being particularly stupid about our government, you see these tiny little things that she does that can be easily shrugged off, but at the same time make you think.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Okay, so the last one, of course, thing about the fashion is that it has been used and is now one of the main cogs of our capitalist world. And yet, at the same time, it is one of the most significant ways that we can express our individualism, our culture, and our heritage.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more choice about what you can wear now than there was in sort of previous decades. In fact, we're going back quite a few decades.
We are, and I do also need to remind people that, you know, having clothes on an industrial scale, it is incredibly recent, and certainly having clothes of such, you know, quality and standard so cheaply available, while some might not be cheap, but, you know, so readily available, is actually an incredibly recent turn of events.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if we go back 200 years, no, probably a bit more than that, sort of 300-400 years, you'd have been weaving your own cloth, probably, unless you were part of the nobility. Even then, you'd have been weaving your own cloth. Just would have been better cloth. if you go back 200 years, you'd definitely been sewing your own stuff, unless you were incredibly wealthy.
Yeah.
And obviously, I can ask for a show of hands, but I won't see them. But how many people here have actually ever made their own clothes? I have, but not because it was a case of I absolutely needed to make my own clothes, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the idea of making your own clothes now or things like that, it's seen as a luxury when before it was a necessity. You know, you wanted something nice to wear, you had to make it. And again, this is not, you know, an old phenomenon either. It's the whole kind of having just clothes that readily available is very, very recent.
Yeah, it is recent. I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but when we were talking earlier about how creating something that is essentially decorative and therefore, you know, useless in terms of being alive is leisure time, and, you know, you're either taking it from yourself or you're taking it from someone else.
Yeah.
It's still the same with cheap clothing nowadays. It just means that if you're not careful with how you source your clothing, you are wearing years of somebody else's life.
You are. Yes.
So, you know, this is something I feel quite strongly about, is that clothes that are made in sweatshops and things and people not really knowing or questioning where their clothes come from. No. I don't want to lecture, but I don't want to say, next time you go and buy something, maybe think about where it's come from and why it only costs what it does.
Yeah. But also, that doesn't just go for clothing which is cheap. That also goes for clothing which is very expensive, big brand, you know, titles and things like that. So you can walk around with the brand itself. Now, I'm not saying, look, if you want to follow fashion or you want to wear, you know, certain brands, go for it, you know, whatever you like. But there are brands who have notoriously, despite the magnitude of what you pay for them, still have most of their things coming out of sweatshops.
Yeah, and that is appalling.
It is.
It really is. I want to just talk about the miniskirt. this seems as good a place as anywhere to slot it, so to speak, because we're talking about clothes as a form of the capitalist society we live in.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you say miniskirt, and probably most people go, ah, 60s kind of thing. Probably. Mary Quant is sort of credited with inventing the miniskirt in sort of around 1966. Before then, it was not done for women to wear skirts that came above their knees. In fact, your skirt would normally be 3 to 4 inches below your knee. So showing your leg... I mean, skirts have gradually risen since the Edwardian era.
Yeah. They go up. Sometimes they go back down again a tiny bit, and then they go back up again.
Yeah, but I mean, even if you're thinking of sort of the Roaring Twenties, you wouldn't have been going for something above the knee. So the miniskirt was kind of like a big statement. That was off the back of the women's lib movement, and you know the feminist drive for equal pay, equal rights, etc. And women were wearing trousers and things around then as well, which again was also quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
So this was kind of a, no, we don't need special clothing. And if we want to display ourselves, we're going to display ourselves however we like. This is to do with having our own sexual agency and sexual freedom and things. So, yeah, miniskirt might not be your item of clothing, but there is a lot attached to it. There's a lot of meaning behind that particular garment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be honest... I'm kind of a little bit sad that skirts aren't so much in fashion, because skirts are really comfortable.
depends on the... I mean, yeah, it depends on the skirt, to be honest.
It does. It does depend on the skirt. I actually really enjoy wearing skirts. I really enjoy wearing dresses in general, to be honest. And I think that is also the nice thing, is that I'm no longer in a position where I have to wear one thing or the other.
Yeah.
So that is quite nice.
I mean, you can more or less wear whatever you want, at least in this particular country, without raising too many eyebrows. And even if you do raise an eyebrow, people are more likely to go, okay, I guess they're just wearing that then, rather than actively take exception to what you're wearing.
It is time to bring cloaks back. Because I guarantee you that if I went into a university class wearing a cloak, all of my students would go, oh my god, is that a cloak? And they'd all love it. I say all of them. Most of them would love it, right?
Yeah.
Right? People see cloaks and they're like, oh, a cloak. But no one's brave enough to wear them. I feel that should be changed.
Yeah. Weirdly, the cloak was also a sign of affluence, because again, it's that excess material. You only need so much to create a coat, but a cloak is lots of excess material.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be, I mean, in the medieval period, that villains and peasants, they weren't even allowed to wear cloaks, were they?
No, it was the sumptuary laws. They weren't allowed to dress above their station.
Yeah.
In the end, that was almost impossible to enforce, especially after the peasants' revolt, because there just weren't enough people to work the fields after the Black Death. So
yeah,
you had to like turn a blind eye to the fact that the farmer down the road actually had some embroidery on his coat and his wife was wearing silk ribbons kind of thing.
She was wearing ribbons. All right, fine, whatever. As long as they're doing their work.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is, you know, we've looked at things historically. What do you think is the idealized beauty standard of today? And I'm posing this question because I think, well, within my lifetime, I've seen it change several times. And it does change quite rapidly.
I definitely have. Well, obviously, I've lived a bit longer than you, so I definitely have. But yeah, just be thankful you didn't live through the 80s and those awful big perms, okay?
I'd have been okay with that. No, I wouldn't.
Seriously, they were, you know, I've got naturally wavy hair, and obviously Madeline's got curly hair, and, you know, neither of really are quite as fashionable as, say, proper sleek locks at the moment, or, you know, sort of last decade. But I have to say, having lived through the 80s and seeing the shoulder pads, the awful teased hair with a ton of hairspray on it, I'm just like, no, it's going to do whatever it wants. I don't care. I refuse to subject my hair to that.
Yeah, it did amaze me, though, that, you know, curly hair was the big thing, and it was big curly hair. We love big curly hair.
Yeah.
And then I just remember so many times in school, when I was little, all I wanted was curly hair, and I wanted curly hair because my mother had curly hair, and I thought that she was one of the most beautiful women in the world, and I loved curly hair. I just thought it was really, really nice. And I had bone straight hair, blonde, bone straight, thin. I didn't like it. And then both my brother and I, we hit adolescence, and our hair just immediately went curly. And so I got my curly hair. I got curly hair and I was thrilled to bits. And then I spent the rest of my school life being told to straighten it. Like, oh, you look so pretty with straight hair. And I was like, no, shut up. I have my curly hair. I made my wish. It came true. I happen to like it. And everyone was saying, you'd look nicer without it. And I did straighten my hair on a few occasions. And I'd look at my face and I'm like, my face does not suit straight hair. It doesn't look good. But they're like, oh, but straight hair's beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't look good on me. But it was the insistence that it should be. And that always really upset me. That also that curly hair was meant to equal, you know, ugliness. And has been used to equal ugliness in a lot of movies and stuff like that. Curly hair and glasses. So, you know, I'm not in good standing if I'm reading a book.
Yeah, so when I was at school, it was you should cut your hair, because it was more in fashion to have sort of jaw length hair.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just above your shoulders. My hair is so thick that, I mean, I say I've got wavy hair, but if I cut it to my just above my shoulders, it would really, really curl. I'm too old to look like Little Orphan Annie, okay? I'm really too old for that shit. And I was also being sort of like, oh, you'd look really good if you had your hair cut really short and had a perm. And I'm like, are you kidding? I've seen your perms and they look bloody awful, kind of thing. I did not say this out loud, even I'm more tactful than that. And, you know, have you ever thought about bleaching it blonde? I'm like, no.
No, I haven't.
I haven't. I've sometimes thought about dyeing it jet black.
I could see you with jet black hair. I personally like your red hair.
I've tried to put black streaks in it a few times over the intervening decades. My hair just doesn't take dye very well.
I just like the idea of your hair just rejecting it. You know, you put the dye in and it just bleeds out and you're like, aw.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah.
Okay, so let's discuss what's the idolized beauty standard of today? So this is what I've got, and Jules, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. There was a while where I've got slim. Right now, being slim is in fashion, and when I say slim, I don't mean having like a small waist necessarily, though small waist good. I mean having slim hips, a slim build, small but shapely breasts, so not massive, but sort of fitting with that slim build. Having pale skin or being tanned. And then having striking hair of some kind. So that could be blonde, it could be red, or it could be black. And if it's brown, it's got to be sort of reddish brown, and then people kind of like that. And then I have pale eyes, so blues and greens, very much in fashion, a small nose, thicker eyebrows, and large lips. I should say, not large lips, but rather quite plump bottom lip.
Yeah, fuller lips.
Fuller lips, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that I agree. Some of it I agree with. Some of it's I don't know. But obviously you have to think about confirmation bias for yourself as well. Not you personally, but anyone.
No, this is true. I mean, I made this list because what I did was that I sort of looked at the female leads that we're getting in a lot of modern movies. Basically, I looked at sort of who the hottest actors were in... particularly in America at the moment, and I just looked through a list of them, and I made that list based on some of the commonalities between them. So yeah, that's what my list is based on.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, as far as I've noticed, gone from being sort of slim but having some curves to being sort of very, very stripped down, and not in a nice, attractive, athletic way, but in a sort of you need to eat more way.
Yeah.
Particularly, okay, the leg thing. Okay, thigh gaps. Mm-hmm. Thigh gaps not attractive, guys. What the fuck are you all thinking? Seriously. I can't stand it. And then people wear these really, really skinny jeans that adhere to everything. And this is men as well as women. And it's supposed to look attractive when you see someone wandering around and they're obviously not very fit. They just don't eat enough. In these really skinny jeans on legs that look like they might snap on the next step, and it's not attractive. What the hell is that?
Yeah. I guess some people find it attractive, and, you know, fair enough to you, each to their own, but I should also say that our idealised beauty standard, it also depends on the role that you're supposed to be playing. And I am very much thinking in terms of films and in terms of fiction at the moment, which is that if you have, and I have to stress, if it's the classy seductress, can be larger. Larger breasts. Sometimes she's blonde, or sometimes she has very dark hair, and she might have darker skin. This is a sort of a bit of a typecasting thing there. They will tend to put, you know, the classy seductress, they might have her as being Latina or something like that. She will have sort of be a little bit sort of darker hair, darker skin, fuller lips, larger body, bigger hips, bigger breasts, still a very skinny waist, thicker eyebrows, potentially a slightly larger nose. But then if you have the innocent debutante, as it were, you know, the young girl, she's almost always white. And she is almost always very slim, very slim. And it's almost like they're trying to get this idea of girly, of girliness, you know, prepubescentness, not hopefully in a creepy way, but in an idea of the innocence equates, you know, she is not yet a woman. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it depends on what you're watching, but
yeah,
there's an element to that.
Yeah. I mean, what would you say is the idealised beauty standard of today, then, Jules?
I am the wrong person to ask for that because this is just a case of there are things which I physically don't find aesthetically pleasing, but if you then introduced me to that person with all the things that I find aesthetically unappealing, and they turned out to have a brilliant mind, suddenly they'd become really, really attractive. So it's not like I even look at someone and go, yeah, that's a nice thing to look at half the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I should say that the standard I'm putting forward is very much, I am basing it on what is considered to be attractive at the moment. So I'm basing it on that for some people, makeup, and I'm particularly talking about makeup. Makeup is something, it is now an art style. And I do see these amazing images of people who've done the most gobsmacking, makeup around their eyes and things like that. The hours and the effort and the steadiness of the hand, you know, they're using themselves as a kind of a canvas. And for some people, it is very much about a confidence thing. They feel better if they are wearing, you know, lots and lots of makeup. And I am not going to judge you for that. And I'm not going to call you ugly for that. In fact, I have never really ever thought of anyone as particularly ugly. Like, you have to be... Usually it's actually to do with the kind of person that you are and the kind of habits that you keep that
will make me
decide whether someone is ugly or not. So yeah, I'm not one to judge on ugliness or anything like that. For me, it is just about expression of the self and individualism. There are certainly things that I don't find particularly attractive. And this is the big difference between saying something is attractive and something is beautiful. When I say attractive, as in like, I myself am not personally attracted to certain things. But I can still appreciate them. Does that make sense at all?
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I'm the same in the sense of no one's really ugly until they've proven themselves to be ugly.
Yeah.
And then they can make themselves utterly repulsive, as in there's no coming back from it kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I clearly don't follow fashion in that respect. And I agree on the makeup thing in the sense of some people do it and it's clearly an expression of who they are, but some people do it because it seems that they think that's what's expected, and then they add a double whammy of, why aren't you doing it? And I think that's where I kind of get off the bus.
Yeah. I have problems the moment that anyone expects their own, you know, expects other people to do what they're doing just because they're doing it.
Yeah. Sort of validate my choices by conforming to them. Yeah, that's a very typical thing with fashion and appearance, particularly now. It's kind of like, well, you're obviously not quite the thing, are you?
No. No, exactly. Okay, so let's do a little bit of discussion about actually, you know, why I kind of wanted to do this episode, and the way that fashion is used in fiction, both well and not so well. So the first one that I want to talk about is basically modern styles used in the ancient world. So why does this happen? Does it work and does it not work? So we mentioned Bridgerton. I do kind of want to talk about Pride and Prejudice a little bit, because you really hit the nail on the head and the way that Darcy is supposed to look. And by God, I'm so glad they didn't try to do that.
I'm really glad. I mean, I remember because when Pride and Prejudice, we're talking obviously about the BBC version, which was out in 1995.
Yes.
We're not talking about anything else at the moment, just to clarify. Yes. But when they were doing it, they were looking at what the men would have actually been wearing in terms of clothing, and the sort of trouser type things they would have been wearing were so unattractive to a modern audience that they kind of went with this sort of just below the knee kind of looser breeches type affair with stockings, yeah, because that made more sense. And, you know, people could get on board with that. And they said at the time, I remember reading the interview, that, yeah, they changed it. It's not quite accurate, but it was so, what they should have been wearing was so unappealing that there was no way they'd be able to sell these guys as romantic leads if they put them in it.
Exactly. I've got to say, though, it almost makes a little bit more sense, though, if you think of Darcy wearing, like, this powdered wig and stuff like that, as if in the film, every time Elizabeth had met him, he was wearing this powdered wig and he had his whole, you know, he had his face all sort of blushed up and rouged and things like that. And then the first time she truly sees him is after he's gone swimming in that lake.
Yeah, and he comes up. He's quite fit.
He's actually quite hot. And he's like, no, wait, let me put on my wig and makeup. She's like, no, no, stay as you are.
Yeah, that would make more sense. And that's the thing to remember, is that how you would judge male attractiveness back then was whether they had shapely calves and ankles. Yeah. If you ever read any of Jane Austen's letters, there's lots of very tongue-in-cheek references to men's backsides. Which is where I kind of, when people say, oh yes, they were all very prim and proper in the Georgian era, it's like, they weren't. The women were making all sorts of arse comments about the men all the time.
Because also you look at the male shoes, and they were high heels, so to enhance the calf. They wore padding around the calf as well. I mean, George the Third was it? No, was it the Fourth? Was George the Third the crazy one?
Yes,
I shouldn't say that, but yeah, he was known as the Mad King George. And George the Fourth, yeah, really made it a big fashion thing to have these huge padded calves.
Yeah, I mean, that was largely because George, the Prince Regent, Prince George, was incredibly unathletic.
Yes.
And lazy. And, you know, instead of doing exercise to sort of develop some calf muscles, decided that padding was the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So yeah, that, so it would have been that, it would have been looking at the calves, because it was about, yeah, look at this athleticism. And that was, I mean, that was the case for a long time. It was all about looking at those male legs, which is why you have all these trousers and styles which really show off the leg. They were essentially wearing leggings.
Yeah, they were essentially wearing leggings the whole time. If we go back a little bit further to the medieval era, again, you will not see this in adaptations, because no one wants to see a lot of men walking around literally wearing tights and cod pieces.
Yes.
And yet the young men, particularly the ones when they were doing their term of service in a grand house, if they were, you know, well connected enough, they were literally basically wearing tights with tie-on cod pieces that kind of exposed the shape of the genitals. And they were left standing around, these young, good-looking men, basically as living ornaments to show how wealthy the householder was.
Yes.
And if you want, a little bit of a... I mean, they had short coats and they had shirts that just came over just to cover the top of the codpiece. It would have been incredibly uncomfortable. If you want a basis for comparison, a very, very young Chaucer was dressed up like this and paraded around like a piece of meat. I kid you not.
I know. I really, really love that, because every time you do that, all I can just imagine is just Gregory finding out and just going, every time. Well,
see, there's the thing. If we're talking about my books, then Gregory would have also spent some time doing that.
I know. It's just the image of Gregory imagining Chaucer wearing that, just going, no.
I'm now imagining Gregory dressed like that, going, sort of like, and everyone going, who's that huge, ugly page over there?
Gregory, it just suddenly trying to imagine Gregory wearing that is especially funny, because you just imagine this really gruff top and then, like, this, like, elegant ballerina-esque little bodysuit. sweaty in the clothes. It's like imagining sort of Blackbeard. The top half Blackbeard, the bottom half ballerina. Anyway, the way sometimes though in period pieces they do show accurate clothing, but that's only for the bad people.
Yeah.
So the undesirable characters will walk around, or the characters you're supposed to mock or supposed to think less of will walk around in fashions of the day, just going, "Oh well, look at me, I look all, you know, la-di-da kind of thing," and everyone, you know, everyone going, "Oh well, yeah, look at them, they look really, really ugly," and it's like, no, they were actually would have been very well dressed and appropriately handsome for the era.
Yeah, definitely. A small sidebar here where I say that I get annoyed in period dramas where they immediately cover everything in a layer of dirt. As it's kind of like, ah, this is the medieval era. Okay, everyone bring in the buckets of mud and let's start sloshing. Yes, let's get it on the peasants as well.
On their faces.
Like, because oh everybody God. Knows that nobody washed sort of before the Edwardian era. This is not true, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, they actually
tried to stay clean.
They did, hey, medieval people were super into washing.
Oh, big time! It was like spa day, you know.
Yeah. yeah. So obviously, these changes have been made. Small changes have been made in order to basically sell the illusion, because the truth is actually too unbelievable now for the modern audience, basically. So there are cases where it's been done well. Pride and Prejudice, I think that they made appropriate changes. Everything else, you know, they kept quite accurate. And certainly in terms of a lot of the female styles and stuff like that, they were quite accurate. Can I just say one of my favourite things about the BBC version is the casting?
Yeah, definitely.
And look, I'm not going to sort of turn my nose up, but I am going to turn my nose up a little bit at the recent version of Emma, which apparently the clothing, the costumes are so accurate. They're incredibly done to the last detail. The costume department has done a brilliant job of including all sorts of wonderful things right, you know, to the very, very last detail. And that's fantastic. Except the problem is that they've got these great things in terms of the costumes, but the actors and the general style of the actors is so modern. It's incredibly modern that I can't watch it. I just can't watch it because they look emaciated.
Yeah, they are very emaciated. They're just, it is that skinny jeans look.
It is.
Costume
it is
drama.
It's the skinny jeans look. Mr. Knightley has got that kind of that woofy hair, you know, and the face, and they just look, they look far too modern. The eyebrows as well, the whole way that everything is done and pieced together, it's just way too modern for something which is kind of hailing itself as being very accurate.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
You then have things like The Tudors, for instance. I don't know if you've watched any of The Tudors, Jules.
Yeah, we watched all of it. I quite liked it. I thought the casting was quite good. And they didn't take too many liberties with the clothing, as I recall.
No. No, they didn't. But I think what they definitely tried to do was in certain cases, they made them quite sexy. Particularly for people like Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
They made certain things quite suggestive, in order to enhance that sense of the fact that she you know, she was seducing the king.
Although, if you look at portraits and accounts of her, apparently she did actually alter her clothing to appear chic and sexy. The thing with Anne Boleyn was she was not considered beautiful at the time.
No.
She didn't have fashionably coloured hair and eyes or anything like that.
No.
She had a, you know, what even Henry said, you know, she had a decent figure kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was more that she was sort of entrancing. And, you know, part of the case against her saying she bewitched the king was the fact that she managed to capture his attention and keep it, even though most people were going, I don't know what he sees in her. She's not a great beauty kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because let's remember that the era was a big fan of the long nose.
Yes. okay, so, all right. Another one I want to touch on is virtue signalling. This annoys me a lot. And it happens particularly in fantasy, or when, you know, you have some cultures where they will use modern clothes or styles to show something is inherently better. You know, it's meant to show greater progress and superiority. Or that you have a character who snubs the styles or etc. and use it as a metaphor for breaking free. So things like, you know, loosening the hair, tearing up the gown, shortening the skirt, ripping away the sleeves, etc. And this is when it really, really annoys me a little bit.
It's a bit of a tough one, that, because, yes, in one sense, sort of just using it as a lazy way to virtue signal is kind of, like, not cool.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's done properly, yes.
But on the other hand, as, you know, most girls were still wearing dresses and things when I was growing up. Well, sort of all the time through choice, rather than you were considered a tomboy if you were always in trousers, because...
Yeah.
And I know this firsthand, since I was always in trousers if I could manage it, and I was called a tomboy. So, you know, I think girls are allowed to wear trousers a lot more at school now. That was absolutely verboten when I was at school.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wore trousers at school.
If I could have got away with wearing trousers at school, I would have done. Obviously, this was not an option. So, yeah, the whole sort of you being forced to wear clothing that doesn't fit you and doesn't suit you and sort of like you just want to tear it apart kind of thing, I completely get that.
Yeah. No, I do completely get that. Don't get me wrong. It's the way that it's used as shorthand that kind of actually turns its nose up at any one particular style and says one thing is inherently good and one thing is inherently bad. Not rather than one thing is inherently not me and one thing, you know, inherently is. So it's not about saying this isn't me. It's about saying this isn't me, therefore it is wrong. And anyone who enjoys it is wrong or weak or stuck in the past or anything like that. That anyone who wears dresses in a world where you can wear trousers is weaker, stupider, you know, more right wing, etc., rather than saying you can wear trousers, rather you can wear a skirt and still be independent and smart, etc., like that. That's when I start to get an issue with it.
Yeah, definitely. Do you want to give some examples?
Okay, so I will have to talk about A Court of Thorns and Roses in a minute. But I'm just going to give actually one small example of a way that it's done. Which is also the idea, okay, Frozen. I like Frozen. I like Frozen 1, I like Frozen 2.
Yeah.
But one thing they did was that they have, obviously, they use Elsa's hair to basically show her kind of losing the rigidity which she's been so stuck in for a very, very long time. And I think that that's done quite successfully. In that, you know, by the end of the second film, her hair is just completely loose. And she sort of very much feels one with nature. One thing that kind of gets me a little bit is that it's just there, like, part of letting it go is I'm going to completely change my outfit so that it's 100% a completely modern style. It is. It is quite modern. The way the cut is, it looks very like, it looks like the modern ideal of a fairy tale gown.
Yeah, it never really struck me as modern, but okay. I thought, considering how long you've got in a film and, you know, you're moving it along through a song and you're also moving along the fact that she's literally sort of, the mask has fallen now, so she's going to try and be herself. I thought that was a relatively good way of signalling.
I agree. Sorry, I should be saying that I didn't. I thought it was done well.
That's what I'm saying. I did think it was done well. I think that they did sort of move along much more towards kind of more modern beauty standards with that one. But I do think it still worked relatively successfully. Mostly because it wasn't that then Anna was seen as doing something bad for not changing her clothes. You know, she sticks with her clothes, she sticks with her style. And it's also the fact that in doing so, Elsa becomes further and further separated from the society that she doesn't actually really kind of in her heart of hearts belong to. So that's a version where I think it's done quite well, where they have gone with a more modern style, I think, whilst, you know, not screwing it too badly. A version when I think we are starting to virtue signal is A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yeah, I have to admit, I don't always pay attention to clothing in books. Sort of, I read it and that sort of goes in one eye and out the other. But yes, the one thing that actually drew me up short was Feyre actually wearing her wedding dress and clearly being very uncomfortable in it and sort of buttoned up and sort of beads of perspiration kind of thing. And then suddenly she's with Rhysand and she's wearing what amounts to harem pants.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like that was a, ooh, that's a whiplash moment almost.
Yeah. Is that it also in particular because basically it was like, oh, well, it's just court differences. And I was just like, you've gone from essentially wearing what appears to be, you know, I mean, I don't even know what the style of clothing is supposed to be, but the way it's described, it does sound very sort of French aristocrat, which fits as well as in that, you know, it's meant to be Beauty and the Beast. So it does actually sound like that's the kind of thing that she's wearing. You know, this huge, huge skirt, very tight puffs, big, you know, big ornamentation. And then the next thing, it's like, ta-da! Now you're wearing harem pants and things like that. And I was like, it gave me a bit of whiplash, but I was like, okay, all right, so it's I get it, it's meant to be sort of, you know, fantasy world, so I guess why not play with stars a little bit. But then the idea of the Night Court isn't just that it's not just that they're wearing something, you know, a little bit different. All of the clothes that she wears with the Night Court are really modern. I mean, there's one bit in one of the latest books where she's just literally wearing just a sweater and it sounds like she's wearing a sweater and leggings. And I was just like, what era is this supposed to be?
Yeah, it's a bit jarring when you've got, like, you know, the human world is very sort of, well, sort of Renaissance peasantry, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that was really what got me, was that for me that was big virtue signalling. Also the idea that, you know, Feyre then starts to wear these very, very sexy dresses. And, you know, before she was all like, no, I don't want to wear dresses, but then suddenly it was okay when she had to wear sexy dresses. And that's become a big part of her identity. Is wearing these, you know, these sexy dresses, or her, you know, her warrior garb, as it were, the Illyrian leathers.
I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Because she has to wear those things so that when she announces for the umpteenth time that she's High Lady of the Night Court, everyone listens.
Yeah. Yeah. she's just wearing a plaque. She's basically wearing a plaque around her her neck. And yet for me that was big, big virtue signalling, which was basically about, look how amazing the Night Court is, and the only way we have to really emphasise how amazing the Night Court is by showing how modern they are, in everything. You wouldn't like to be in a restrictive dress. No, we're going to put you in the clothes that you feel kind of familiar with. And I just thought, okay, but Feyre was already wearing clothes she was familiar with before. Like, she was wearing those hunting clothes. You know, she was wearing trousers, she was wearing things like that anyway, when she was out doing tasks in the human world.
I think the costume changes to me kind of signal some laziness, in the sense of rather she, Sarah J. Maas, kind of skipped over the whole, you're basically marrying a fey prince, therefore you need to dress to your station, and we haven't had that conversation on page. And maybe that would have been an important part of their relationship to address.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely see that. And obviously, you know, the whole concept is that Rhysand's court doesn't, you know, have the same formalities, that it's a family rather than a court. Which is very fanciful and very, very nice. but yes. We're not going to go into that. But for me, it really kind of was a little bit much, I think, in the sudden inclusion of very, very modern styles and very, very modern clothes, in all about just trying to make the Night Court seem that much more amazing. When I thought that it wasn't that necessary to do that.
Yeah, I think the way it was all connected with completely tearing down Tamlin as well.
Mm.
It's kind of like, there must be nothing that is left untouched. There must be no reason for her to have any regrets or go back, etc. And it was just overdone.
Yeah.
In that respect.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the last one, which is using clothes to send a message. Now, I have to mention Gentleman Jack here.
Yeah, it's interesting because Anne Lister did actually used to dress like that.
She did, yeah. And because I did see a thing which was basically about the sort of the costume designs and stuff, which is that they did take some liberties. They took liberties with her hair, for instance, and things like that, because they didn't know exactly what was happening and they didn't know exactly what, you know, would have been done. But they could make assumptions based on the era, but also, most importantly, the character as well. So they made this very small but very smart decision to make Anne Lister's hairstyle more masculine than the typical feminine style, as well as, you know, the clothes that she wore and stuff like that, all to send that signal that she's the boss. That's what she's doing. She's in charge. She's taking on this traditionally male role. That's how she sees herself.
Yeah, definitely. To be clear, having read her diaries, Anne Lister did not see herself as a man. She was very, very pro being female. In her opinion, women were better than men. They were superior.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of weird sort of sexual stuff tied up into that as well. She's very sort of pro women, loving women. Mm-hmm. I've got a horrible feeling that if she had lived today, she would actually probably be a TERF kind of thing.
Yeah.
There are some not so great aspects, but you know, these are important historical documents, and yeah, she eschewed a lot of the frilliness and delicate femininity because it didn't suit her. She knew it didn't suit her. By the standards of the time, at 5'7", she was considered very tall and mannish. So she sort of went, well, I'm going to wear what makes me comfortable kind of thing, which included an awful lot of black.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought that they did a really, really good job of using clothes to show that on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Another example is Game of Thrones. Now, we have our misgivings about Game of Thrones, but none of them are with the costume department.
No, the costumes were fantastic. And, you know, the fact that it is actually a fantasy world gave them a bit of a liberty in the sense of, well, we can have styles that sort of suit where we are in the world kind of thing in Westeros.
Yeah. And the thing I really liked is that they did come up with different kind of styles. They weren't just saying, okay, we'll just pick from this part of history or anything like that. These were fantasy styles, fantasy hairstyles, fantasy clothing styles. I mean, I particularly like the way that they did the wrap of the dresses for in Westeros, you know, sort of society, and the way that they had their certain styles, which I thought worked really, really well, were very beautiful. And they had small, subtle changes, decisions with fabrics and things like that. And the thing I particularly liked was that it wasn't just for the women, it was for the men too. And they did tie cultural things into it. For example, I really liked the touch about the Dothraki hair.
Yeah.
you know, the idea that they would have these bells and this very intricate hair, very, very long, and the idea is that you had, you know, a different one for every, you know, victory you had. So you'd have these men with this incredibly long hair with these intricate braids and these bells and things like that to basically signal what brilliant warriors they were, which I thought was fantastic. And then you also had small subtle changes, like the way that they did Sansa's clothing and hair was that her hair would change according to whoever she was closest to, whoever she was emanating at any given time. So, for example, right, you know, in the season one, you see her emanating a lot of the styles that Cersei is wearing. And then after, you know, she becomes a prisoner, she begins to wear her hair in a style which is much more similar to her mother. And then she copies Margaery Tyrell.
Yeah.
And then she starts wearing things similar to her aunt. You know, she changes her hair according to the kind of the social circle that she's in order to fit within it, kind of like a chameleon. And, you know, in the book, she's actually getting quite smart. She's getting quite streetwise in terms of how she's going to survive and do that. And I think that those subtle changes that they did with her hair really allowed the, you know, it to be demonstrated on screen what was happening underneath.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of the great things about costume is that when you have the limited time that a adaptation or screen adaptation provides, you can use, mm-hmm. you know, just one shot can tell the audience an awful lot. So things like costume and hair, etc., really do set the tone and signal what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. The last one I want to talk about is the Hunger Games.
Yeah, that's a really good example because, you know, obviously the Hunger Games is about revolution and sedition and the choices of clothing and things, particularly described in the books, they are actually very seditious choices. Mm. So even though they're being forced to take part in this really brutal arena, this brutal practice of pitting children against children in order to keep everyone ground into the dirt, the fact that they're going out there and wearing things, you know, and then gaining popularity through wearing these things, gaining support yeah. essentially for a revolution is very, very clever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the visuals which always really sticks out to me, is when Katniss volunteers herself. You have, oh God, I've just forgotten her name, the woman who's there to pull out the names and stuff like that.
Effie Trinker, I think.
That's it, Effie. And you have all of these people in the art who are wearing these very practical working clothes, and it's basically a sea of grey. And then you have Effie, and she's got butterflies in her hair, and she's wearing the most impractical clothing. And she's obviously the spokesman from the Capitol. The contrast there is fantastic. You see this absolute decadence. The idea also of a complete illusion. The illusion that the people in the Capitol are under. This illusion of beauty and, you know, entertainment and everything being visually spectacular. And I really, really like the way that they do use fashion, as you say, in the series. The whole idea of the clothes that sort of go onto fire, the wedding dress that becomes the Mockingjay, you know, things like that, that with the flames and stuff like that. All these quiet signals, you know, in this case we're using it as symbolism, it's political, it's eye-catching, and it really demonstrates the point of this completely capitalist, consumerist world, where the only way for the message to get across is to scream louder and brighter than anything that already exists.
Yeah, it's interesting because the clothing and things start off quite subtle, and you get some of it in the films, but the books go into a bit more detail and then become more and more overt until you're literally sort of, she's literally transforming herself into a mockingjay.
Yeah.
And having just read A Ballad of Songbirds and Serpents, which sort of is the prequel to The Hunger Games, you kind of, I mean, I know it's written after the Hunger Games trilogy, so in some respects it's retconning, but you can see, you find out why the Mockingjay and why the singing and why the clothing and things really put the wind up President Snow.
Yeah.
You get to see all those things, and the fact that this must have been in Suzanne Collins's mind all the way through is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I am fashion tuckered out.
Yes, me too. Don't ever come to me for fashion advice. Unless it's for a historical piece, in which case, then yeah, I can probably help.
Yeah. My advice will always be, what do you like wearing? Okay, wear that. Off you go.
The only thing I will say before we go is, if you're writing, you're essentially, even if it's fantasy, you're setting it in a contemporary setting, so you're writing urban fantasy, and you're worried about aging your prose by what your characters are wearing, my piece of advice would be, don't go for something that is clearly the fashion of the moment. So there are things which are classic for several decades, so looking at things like, you know, jeans and sweatshirts and things and the little black dress, etc., they don't really ever go out of fashion and keep coming around again. Whereas if you put someone in a shell suit, for example, I don't know if shell suits are coming back again, but that's very, very sort of early 90s.
That you're absolutely right that if you decide to very much kind of focus on the fashion of today, you are going to limit yourself by saying, well, that's beautiful, it's beautiful for now. But what will happen is that you will actually end up aging your work a great deal. It's like using references in your work. It works for the moment, but depending what the reference is, you will age your work considerably. Now, that means, however, that, you know, if you are writing something which is set in a certain period, so you're like, I'm writing in the 90s, put them in 90s clothes. That's fine. That's okay. But yeah. Definitely. Be conscious of that.
I mean, even if you're doing it, sort of, you're setting it now, I think you've got a bit more leeway with something that's like urban fantasy, simply because people are like, well, it's urban fantasy, it's set then, it's fine, we'll go from there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of like Harry Dresden's Leather Duster. That's a classic. That's never going out of fashion.
Nope, that's never going out of fashion.
That's an iconic PI type, you know, the leather jacket for a female PI or female sort of urban fantasy heroine. Again, that's not really going out of fashion. You might want to make it vegan leather, but
yeah.
Which is interestingly made out of mushrooms, so there you go.
Okay, that's very interesting, because I thought, well, because it depends on what kind of leather you are. Fake leather, though, sometimes is plastic, which is just worse for the environment. So much worse.
Yeah, I mean, when I said earlier, you know, people are never going to judge you for what you're wearing on the street, probably. Unless you're walking down the street wearing a fur coat.
Yeah, then they might judge you.
They might, yeah, that might be a bit of an issue. You might get someone come up to you and say something, and I have to say I have feelings about wearing fur myself.
Yeah. Okay, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
Yes, we started off talking about froth with Bridgerton, and I'm presenting you with more froth, but in the urban fantasy genre.
Hooray!
I mentioned that I've read some of Molly Harper's books a while back. I've actually gone back and started with her Jane Jameson series.
Okay.
Basically, small southern town librarian has the worst day of her life and wakes up a vampire.
Ooh!
And it goes on from there, and it plays on familiar tropes and things, and it's quite snarky and funny, and it's light, and it doesn't take itself too seriously. And, you know, she's a funny main character. And I think, I mean, I'm on the second book now, and basically I think these four books are like looking at her adjusting to, from being human to being a vampire. She's just in a huge rant about the fact that she hasn't eaten, actually physically eaten food for months. She's like, do you know what it's like for someone like me to go without chocolate? She can't eat it because vampires can't digest human food.
Oh, no.
So, Yeah, it's really interesting. And then there's the whole sort of like, yeah, okay, I'm a vampire, but I'm basically the same person. Why are all these really pallid goths coming up and bending down to literally kiss my feet kind of thing? This is weird and creepy. Go away. I don't have wisdom. I'm literally 27 years old. So, yeah, they're very funny. I think they were written sort of... I think they were published of 2012. So you might look at them and go, oh, I'm not sure people would use some of those phrases and things now. But there's nothing really offensive in there, in my opinion.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much for that recommendation. And thanks very much for listening, guys. Do get in touch with us. What are your thoughts about fashion? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Do you have any points to add, or films or books that you've read which have done fashion well or very, very badly? Do let us know. Remember, you can get in contact with us via Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.